I'm going to talk about what I call the product defense industry and the manufacture of doubt. I think everybody in this room and this conference is very familiar, too familiar, with the tobacco industry's campaign. There's a famous memo that now gets cited pretty widely from a Brown and Williamson executive who wrote, "Doubt is our product, since it's the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. It's also the means of establishing controversy." And as we know from the millions of pages of documents that have been made available, secret documents from the tobacco industry hired a cadre of scientists who were willing to testify, sometimes under oath, that they believed that tobacco did not cause lung cancer, did not cause heart disease, that it was not addictive. And that continued for quite a long time. But it was really a very impressive campaign. It wasn't just, hire some scientists to say something. But it was from starting in the 1950s. This was orchestrated originally by the Hill and Knowlton Company. They actually, even in the 1960s, had a publication. This is just, I think, a remarkable example. This was a newsletter sent out to doctors and scientists and to opinion leaders, called Reports on Tobacco and Health Research. And the memos describing how to put this together, what should go into this publication, was anything that raised doubts about the relationship between tobacco and lung cancer at the time. I mean, at the time we weren't talking about some of the other illnesses. And this came out every 2 months. There were numerous ways that the tobacco industry attempted to essentially convince both the scientific community and the public that not that cigarettes were safe, but that the evidence that cigarettes were dangerous was in question. And this campaign of manufacturing doubt was quite successful for many years, and essentially tobacco was able to proceed unregulated, unfettered, selling a product that killed hundreds of thousands of people, and rarely, until recently, ever having to pay any compensation for it. The people who put that campaign together have gone on to bigger and worse things. The Hill and Knowlton, the public relations company that helped come up with the campaign, later marketed their services quite widely. Now, this is from a letter that was sent to a major beryllium company, essentially saying, "Beryllium has a public relations problem. We can do for you what we did for," and these were some of the different areas. They didn't even talk about tobacco in this memo, because I think this was written in the late 90s or in the early 90s. It was already, at that point, they didn't want to be associated with tobacco, but they were able to use that same approach various different places. I happened to see this memo because at the Energy Department, we regulate beryllium. So we learned a lot about beryllium. We had to essentially respond to this sort of thing. But let me give you one of these case histories from this letter. Now, this was on fluorocarbons and ozone depletion. Now, remember, there were three scientists in the middle 1980s who essentially realized that chlorofluorocarbons were probably responsible for causing the hole in the ozone. There was increasing the amount of UV that was getting into the earth, and it was accepted pretty rapidly, and we even had the Treaty of Montreal that controlled fluorocarbon exposure. So this describes what Hill and Knowlton did, and you don't have to read the whole thing, but in the part in yellow here, "Public concern and the fear about the future caused fluorocarbon users to look to alternatives." And obviously you had a problem with people, the manufacturers of this. "Hill and Knowlton was asked by DuPont to help calm fears, get better reporting the issues, and gain up to 2 or 3 years before the government took action to ban fluorocarbons." And they were successful. It took a few more years. Eventually this stuff was banned, but by then DuPont lost no market share. They had new product in there, but we had 2 to 3 more years of fluorocarbons being led into the atmosphere and a larger ozone hole. And of course, at the end of the story, these guys actually got the Nobel Prize for their work. There was no question about the science, but Hill and Knowlton knew that you could question the science and say, "We need more research. We shouldn't do anything yet." Now, that approach has gotten widespread use, and this is from a memo they're probably showing at the climate change session at the same time here. Frank Luntz, who was a consultant to the Republican Party. This actually is a memo to the Republican National Committee, I think, describing, and this was written at the beginning of the Bush administration, how to deal with global warming. "If we can," and this is just a little piece of it, "here, the scientific debate remains open. Voters believe there is no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe there are scientific issues, the scientific issues are settled, their view about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate." And that's what they did, and that's what they've essentially had to stop doing it, because just like tobacco, the science became overwhelming, but they got a few more years and were paying the price for it. It turns out, less well known, is there is now a whole industry of people, of scientists, who do this for a very lucrative living. They defend products, and they call themselves product defense specialists. This was from a PowerPoint presentation we found on the web from one of these companies, the Weinberg Group. This is how they're selling their services: asbestos, tobacco, pharmaceuticals. We're all next. We've got to take this on. Let me give you an example of what one piece of work the Weinberg Associates, Weinberg Group did, and this was actually on their website till I wrote about it in an article in Scientific American, which, at which point they took it off. But this is sort of describing how they support drug manufacturers. The FDA proposed cancellation of a registered new drug. Cancellation requires administrative hearing. Now, the FDA cancels drugs for two reasons. One is that they don't work, or two is that their risks outweigh their benefits. And so this was the drug company retained the Weinberg Group, and you skip to the end here. Essentially, they were able to work on this, so it led to an extensive process with a written appeal from the first decision, linked to 10 additional years of sales prior to ultimate cancellation. So the FDA eventually prevailed, but for 10 years, and I don't know which drug this is, but they either sold it, were able to sell a drug that didn't work or that its risks outweigh the benefits. And eventually, of course, it got taken off the market, but that's, you know, not the point. This is the work that they do for these companies. Another example, which is sort of under the radar screen right now, is benzene, a very well-known, recognized human carcinogen, recognized by the National Toxicology Program and the International Agency for Research on Cancer. You'll hear more about that later as a human carcinogen. There is no doubt about its human carcinogenicity. But there is a question about at what level the toxic effects of benzene occur. OSHA has a standard of 1 part per million. Theoretically, that's based on there have been studies that show that above 10 parts per million, there were excess leukemia cases. But in environmental occupational health, we believe there is no safe level of exposure to benzene. We just don't have the studies at these very low levels. Well, the National Cancer Institute and the Chinese Academy of Preventive Medicine have done a series of studies in China, very important studies, where there still is widespread benzene exposure, a great deal of variation in exposure levels in factories. And this was published in 97 in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, essentially showing that at levels under 10 parts per million, there is still a doubling of the risk of blood cancers. Now, this has great implications for not just occupational health, but environmental health, because benzene is released into the environment in gasoline and would require reformulation if low levels of benzene are shown to be carcinogenic. There's benzene in lots of Superfund sites. It's a very important issue. So this got the oil industry extremely worried. What did they do? They couldn't take on this study directly. So another sort of strategy that they did was they came up with, they're going to do their own study in China. And now these are some memos that have been were found in a court case in Texas against some of the oil companies, where they found these. They essentially said that the American Petroleum Institute put this together, a big study in Shanghai, to respond to the allegations. That's what we're talking about. The National Cancer Institute study is called The Allegations from a Nationwide Study of Benzene-Exposed Workers in Over 50 Industries by Researchers of the U.S. National Cancer Institute. So they've said they need to raise some money to essentially take on this Chinese study by doing their own study. And here's why they have to do that. It's really fascinating. They said, we're going to raise this money because we need new research, because the expected health effects of ambient air concentration of benzene currently drive calls for reformulation of motor gasoline, which have massive financial impact on petroleum refiners, who are obviously impoverished. It would be very expensive for them to get the benzene, lower the benzene level so people wouldn't get leukemia. There are concerns about local impact of benzene exposure. Benzene is in a lot of Superfund sites, and there's a lot of litigation. People are suing companies who, when workers have gotten leukemia or multiple myeloma, some of the other diseases, they sue the oil companies, and they want some protection from these suits. So they want to do their own study, and this is really the amazing part of the document. Before taking on the study, they already know what the study will say. The planned research is expected to provide strong scientific support for the lack of risk of leukemia at current levels, establish adherence to that exposure to adherence to current occupational exposure limits will not create a significant risk. Why is that? Well, the study is designed to show that it's safe. And you can look at the power, and you know, when you're an epidemiologist, you dive in, you see exactly how they're going to do it. And these studies will get lots of press, And they will show, they will essentially, they won't show that benzene isn't dangerous, but they will be enough to refute the previous studies and create enough doubt that nothing will be done with the first set of studies that the NCI paid for. And of course, this is going to cost $20 million, and they already have a plan how they're going to divide it across different refiners and how much each one's going to put in. So this is extremely widespread. This, and there's a lot of people doing this work. It's very successful, and it really, it pollutes. It, you know, by seeding these articles, I think it pollutes and destroys the scientific literature. This is a study recently published in the Environmental Health Perspectives, looking at the different studies of this chemical called bisphenol A. And if you can just look at this essentially 3 2-by-2 tables, showing that looking at that point, there were, 116 or so, or 115 different studies on this chemical. Some, 104 of them done by the government, 11 done by corporations. And you could see the studies that are done by corporations find no harm. And the studies done by the government scientists, the vast majority find some harm. And this is really what's going on. And there are whole journals now, which are really captured journals or vanity journals, where industry scientists publish essentially this large amount of garbage. In fact, and they put out their own journals. This is a journal, the Bisphenol A Global Industry Group puts out this journal to look like an academic journal, where they reprint their own articles and give it out to people to show them that this stuff is safe. Now, some of this is very crude, and I think the examples I've been talking about in terms of benzene and the Weinberg group are very crude, but in fact, I think money does change everything. I think money changes your view of how you do your research and how you interpret research findings. And Vioxx is an incredible example of this, because, you know, this is one of the few drugs where there actually were several sets of clinical trials where the first ones, they compared Vioxx to naproxen, to Aleve, and then later on they did a clinical trial comparing it to a placebo. So we really know the answer at the end, but if you look at what people were saying at different points, you can see a lot about this. Right at the time Vioxx was essentially allowed by the FDA to be sold, there were already plenty of indications that it increased risk of heart disease, or of heart attacks. I think by 2001, now remember it just went on the market really in 2001, or 2000, you had one review in JAMA by three very well-known scientists associated with Case Western, essentially showing they analyzed a couple of the studies that were used to market, to allow licensing FDA, and they showed that the risk of taking Vioxx compared to naproxen against Aleve was more than a doubling of heart attack risk. So what did how did scientists working for Merck respond? They said, well, you know, there are two ways to look at a clinical trial that where you're comparing Vioxx to naproxen. You could say that the people who took Vioxx had twice the risk of heart attack, or the people who had naproxen had half the risk, because naproxen must be protective, because Vioxx couldn't possibly be dangerous. And there was a campaign around that. Merck actually counterattacked, and these are scientists not just who work for Merck, but these are independent, so-called independent scientists, and they work for academic universities and hospitals, but they're consultants to Merck, and they went out and said, well, differences observed between, this is Vioxx, and naproxen are likely the result of the antiplatelet effects of naproxen. Look, if we, and you know, there are a number of these where they show, they attacked Merkogene, Nissen, and Topol for saying, you know, that was a bad study. Really, the Aleve prevented heart attacks. Now, if we had a drug that prevented 50% of heart attacks, we'd be putting it into the water supply. But they really believe that it must be that the people taking naproxen had lower heart attack risk. Now, you know the end of the story. They did the clinical trial comparing naproxen Vioxx to a placebo. September 2004, they broke the secrecy part because they could. The statisticians showed that Vioxx greatly increased the risk of heart attack. By then, estimated 20 million Americans had taken the drug, and there are FDA scientists who estimated between 88,000 and 140,000 heart attacks occurred in the U.S. alone as a result of this. And I don't believe, actually, that these scientists who were working for Merck really did believe that they were hiding something that caused heart attacks. I think they just convinced themselves that Merck must be making a safe product. And if you gave them a lie detector test, they would say, yeah, that's a safe product. It must be the Aleve that's causing, you know, protecting people from heart attacks. And that's what this conflict, the problem with conflict of interest. The people, money does change everything. It's very widespread. I talk about this a great deal. This is in my book that Barry mentioned. It's coming out shortly. There's some flyers in the back, or you could see see more at the Oxford table here. But I'm not the only one talking about that. I've been proudly talking about this for a while. This was Dilbert last week. And you can see what Dogbert's suggestion, recommending paying weasels to write articles casting doubt on the data. And that's what's going on, and there's quite a bit of it. So what do we do? And we're going to address this in sort of the rest of the panel, but the first thing, obviously, is that from simple to much more difficult to get to, full disclosure and publication of conflict of interest. At this point, many journals require conflict of interest disclosure, but it's up to the editor to decide, well, is this significant enough to publish? Well, it doesn't have to be published, but it should be put online. The people need to have access to that information. You can't just leave it to an editor to say, well, I didn't think it was very significant, so I didn't say anything about it. So that would be recommendation number one. But the second and beyond this is conflict of interest can't really be managed. You know, we have advisory panels where people have conflict of interest, and federal agencies think through disclosure and occasional recusal, you can manage conflict of interest. It's just not true. You can't do that, and I think Dr. Culiano, Vince is going to talk about that shortly. But I think it's extremely important to recognize this and to minimize the use of conflicted scientists on advisory panels. A subset of this, which has come up very recently, is the employees of product defense firms are trying to get on federal advisory panels, not just because they have expertise, but they sell their services to influence the government. It's not just that they're there because they're experts, but companies hire these firms like Weinberg, there's one called ChemRisk, essentially because they want to change regulation. They want to make sure that things don't get worse for the company. So these people are regularly nominated to be on advisory panels, and every time we see that, we try to write a letter saying, you know, don't put someone who works for a company whose interest is changing the regulation or affecting the way the government thinks about a chemical hazard or a drug on the advisory panel. They just shouldn't be there. Scientists' control of work product. You know, the leading medical journals do not allow publication of articles if the first author didn't have the unfettered right to publish. In other words, the sponsor of the study can't have control over whether or not it gets published or what the article says. But there are only about 14 journals in the country that have that. Now, the leading journals, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, et cetera, have those rules. But most journals don't have those rules. And I think that's something that we should at least know about. And if a sponsor has control of a study, essentially journals should say we shouldn't publish those studies. And finally, I think we have to level the playing field. Equal treatment of public and private science. Right now, if the federal government pays for a study, the raw data is available or are available for anybody to analyze. There are all sorts of open and transparency requirements. That's not true for studies done by private companies that then are sent into regulatory bodies. So those are the four things we can do, which I think are very important, that really can improve the situation. I'll put these overheads up on our website. Susan Wood and I both are with the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy at George Washington University School of Public Health, where we have a lot of articles and materials on these materials. And she and I both write for a blog now called The Pump Handle, and you can see more of it there. So thank you very much.
Excuse me. Would you be willing to come up and just speak right into the microphone here? Thank you. Appreciate that.
I was saying that for 26 years I worked for WHO, and we tried to encourage the use of the outcome of research. We were not very successful in a few facts. First, we did not advertise the problem of opposing to the outcome of research the enunciation of a possibility, not proven possibility, even if it is a remote one. The second thing is that we were not very successful in improving the access to the outcome of research to all the statements of the academic community and the users of this product. I am very, very pleased that this was brought up, and these are problems that need to be faced, especially the distinction between a possibility and a proven fact. This is the weapon we have to gain this battle. Thank you.
Thank you very much.